So, it's getting later in the day. Oh. I'm happy to introduce you to Alexis Roussel, Mr. Francais. So this is an English talk, as you might observe already. Alexis is going to give you a very interesting proposal, digital integrity of the human person as a new fundamental right. Alexis is totally qualified to do this because he's trained as a lawyer, and in another life he has been the president of the Swiss Pirate Party. So welcome, Alexis.
Thank you. I have the exception to be able the authorization to be able to make a presentation in English. My German is good for understanding, so if you ask questions in German, that will be fine. But it's I feel more comfortable speaking English, so I had the authorization of the head of the Digital Gesellschaft to do so. I'm going to talk to you about a concept which we've been working on since several years, and now it's getting some traction, and it's getting into a more active mode. So we went from thinking to now starting to implement, and basically we're making a lot of presentation like this and some work to get around this new concept. So first a bit the context of why I pinpoint this new digital right, and why did we need these kind of things. So a bit the context. So as was said in the introduction, I was president of the Pirate Party of Switzerland 8 years ago now. It's been some time. I'm still pirate in the heart, and I'm still with them. But at that time, when I went into politics, what struck me was the difference between the two worlds. You know, we had two generations that was fighting each other, and this is one of the key moments where this fight was seen. It's during the trial of Peter Sunde in Sweden, where there's a very good documentary about it, and the judge wants to connect to Peter Sunde. He wants to be young and techie. So he says, yeah, but you were meeting IRL. And then Peter Sunde said, no, we don't like the expression IRL, which means in real life, because we say AFK, away from keyboard, because for us, the internet is real. So basically, he was saying to the judge, you think the internet is just something else. It's like Angela Merkel Neuland. But for us, it's an extension of our life and our world. And the whole debate about peer-to-peer at that time, it wasn't about copyright. It was building new public spaces where people could live. So that was a good example that struck me at that time and that pushed me. I mean, I was already in politics before that, but that was one of the key things that came out. The other thing, which is more negative, is how the Silicon Valley, but also all the governments in Europe, when they are now building, they want to be pro-tech. They are building the industry. They lay the ground of all the regulations to foster this data-driven industry. And they claim that data, personal data, is the oil of the 21st century. And I always felt that that was wrong. Somehow it is wrong. Data is extremely powerful, like oil, yes it is. It has full of energy, yes it is. But for me, I think it's more because it's about people. You know, it's not just a product, it's people. So that was the context which pushed me in that direction. So I said, I'm a lawyer, I'm also looking all the development of the data protection law. And we see a lot of new legal rights which are appearing, so that's a big movement which is called the human digital rights movement. You see the right for access, the right for to be forgive, to erase data, these kind of rights that appear. But a lot of people are looking for a more core human right, something that would be like an umbrella around this. So I'm a lawyer, I'm a politician, I also love history, and I'm looking how the revolutions have already been done. And in reality, when you look and when you study the traditional revolutions, and in Switzerland, even though we didn't have much blood being spilled here, we were a core part of this humanist revolution in the 17th or 18th century. But you see that there is a connection between a new innovation, which is a information innovation like printing press, and then a few centuries later, it is being used to promote new rights. And again, the internet has produced a new way of printing data and sharing data, and this will be a source of new, of rise of new rights, and we see it already happening. So then, my construction was to go try to see from the top. And when you look at the Constitution, when you read the Constitution or the Declaration of Human Rights, you will see that at the top of all of it, there is one thing called the right to life. The right to life has some core, it means that every individual has the right to be there, okay? And then from there, this is the most important rights because all the other rights derive from the right to life, okay? If you don't have the right to life, then you don't have any other rights. It has a history, which is very long. It started with Christianity and Judaism, where like, you shall not kill, that's this basic concept. But it has been actually written in our constitution, written in our Declaration of Human Rights, pretty recently, okay, in the last one or two centuries. The right to life, to understand it, it's the right to be born, the right to be dead. There is a few rights that you have like this that come with you as a person. But it's also a right which is extremely large. You know, we don't give much detail about it. It's for every human to have one. You know, but we don't define really how you are human. If you have one leg less than the others, you are still human. So it's not about how you define human, it's more about you define there is a human, it is born, and it has a right to life. Some constitutions, and like the Swiss one, for example, try to give a bit of a more detail, and basically, based on our culture, we said that there is a body and there's a soul. So we define that there is a physical integrity of the body that should be protected. At the same time, we decided that there's a mental integrity of the person that should be protected. These principles are in Article 10 of the Constitution. They're very vague, but they are there, and all the rest of the laws, the criminal law and the civil law, derive from those rights. So every time there's interaction between the people and the state, or between individuals, or between individuals and company, it has to be done in the respect of the physical and mental integrity of everyone, which is normal, because if you don't, you see abuses. Some abuses, for example, like are almost at the limit. You know, advertising can be seen as a harm to your mental integrity, but still, so that's why there are rules about advertisement. So this is the actual context. And if we go back to what Peter Sander said, our life has been, our space has been extended to the digital cell, to the digital part, and. And we can also claim that our life have been extended to the digital realm. So when you are born today, I was maybe still lucky to be born in a time, or lucky or not, but born in a time where if you were born physically, you didn't exist electronically. Today, it's all together. When you are even conceived, your parents are talking about you. There is medical data to follow up, to monitor the birth of the child, and when you are born, you already have a lot of extensive data, not only health data, administrative data, and also just your parents sharing on the social networks the scan of the belly. So your first picture even before you are born. So the right to, and the right to life actually the same way exists before you are born. So this is the abortion debate. So we see that the life. By birth, you are really digital, and when you are dying, there is a right to die, and when you are dying, something also happens on the digital space, and this is something we are learning right now, you know, how you die on the digital space. So it goes together, and my claim is to say that the right of life includes the digital part of ourselves. So the concept is very simple, is that next to your physical and mental integrity, you also have a digital integrity. It represents yourself, your digital self, and the fact that it should, if you want to be free, if you want to be autonomous in your own decision. And if you want this, what we call the self-determination of your will, then you need to guarantee this integrity. And if you guarantee it also in digital space, then you allow people to be autonomous and free. That's a very basic thing. So when you go in there are some consequences. And they are the first consequence, and this is actually has been already pinpointed, is that the personal data, which makes up this digital self, it's a very blur thing. It's not like a body that you can think you know what is a physical body, but it's like a blur thing about all your data, which are stored everywhere, what you produce. You know, there's some studies also on what are the personal data and the different layers of it. So it's all of it somehow. Okay, and all of these data, they are not objects. They are elements from your digital self. They're elements from your person. So this is interesting because it was already pointed out by an association which is called AFAPDP. AFAPDP is an association where all the data protection agencies, so the Swiss EDOP, it's a French-speaking association. So you have the Swiss EDOP, you have the French CNIL, the Canadian ones, Belgium ones, some African ones. Okay, so it's about 30 different data protection agency, and they have declared this in 2018 that personal data is not an object that can be sold. It is an element of your body, and then you have rights which are inalienable, so you cannot give them away, like your body. It compares your body to it compares your data to organs of your body. For me, it also flips the coin about harvesting data. Today, we consider that harvesting data is something which is admissible, even if you as an individual doesn't have any relationship with the company or the state or the service which is harvesting data on you. And this should be flipped. By default, harvesting data should not be authorized unless consent is given, and a formal, informed consent. So again, like I said at the beginning, the space where we are living in is a unique space. It's not a parallel universe. And all the theories, all the work that is being done, thinking that it's two different worlds, needs to stop. So we have to think about a whole environment of life, including the digital side. One also important thing is that we have to admit one thing, and is that it is impossible for a human being to know where its data is. People don't have any clue about the extent of their digital self. This is the case. You don't know in which databases you are. You don't know what is the impact of you clicking on some button. It creates a lot of actions and data around you, which you are not aware of. And even if you're a super scientist expert who knows how internet works by heart, you won't know how much data you produce. And today, we see that many of the laws that we have, especially in Switzerland, the data protection law, assume that you know where your data are so you can defend them. You can defend yourself against someone who's harvesting data and manipulating you. So that should be reversed. You don't need to know where your data is to be protected. And that's one of the consequences. So is the right to digital integrity compatible with the actual laws that we have? So it's definitely, we'll take the most modern one, which is the GDPR, and the Swiss law is still made on a very ancient model. Just for you to know, in the 70s, when you have the first data protection laws, the scenario that we had to face were completely different. It was the state who were starting to create database for registers, for tax register, for civil register, whatever, and you had no digital existence. So the only thing was to protect you from abuse from the governments to harvest data in an incorrect way. Now we have changed. We're in a more active way. We are producing ourselves a lot of data. We're using a lot of services. We are exchanging. We are having experiences. We are making. We are working in this environment. So it's completely different, and the laws had a bit time to adapt. So GDPR is on the way for this. So it's not incompatible in the sense that it will start if there is a overarching digital integrity right. Then all the rights which are in the GDPR, they just are tools and specific rights to apply to be allowed to respect this digital integrity of the human person. So, but there is one point which is extremely incompatible in that GDPR. Is actually the most important article. And when I first read the GDPR, I just stopped at this article and I say, okay, this is bullshit. Why? Even though some people think all of the rest is good, because GDPR has an Article 2, which is the material scope. And the material scope, there is what is included and what is excluded. And what is excluded is actually any behavior from the state if it concerns security from very far away, even like just making some inquiries, is enough for them to disregard any rights or rules which are in the GDPR. So there is the Convention 108 from the Council of Europe, which is trying to reduce a bit that gap. But this security black hole that we call, it's a common thing. It's also like in the Patriot Act in the US, you have the same kind of security black hole. Basically, if it's for security, they can do whatever they want. So that we need to stop. So why do we need such a right? There is few reasons why we need to have this right, but it imposes, if we put this in the Constitution, it imposes the state to interact with the citizen in a way that it doesn't harm them, okay? But also digitally. So this is the case by we force them already to respect our dignity, to respect our physical and mental integrity in the relationship, but they also have to respect us and to interact with the way that is digitally safe, which tells me, for example, that if a police officer uses a Stat Trojan with a 0 day in it, and the 0 day is actually setting a vulnerability or using a vulnerability which is available everywhere, he's not being safe with the society. He's actually being harmful. It has also pushed the state to give the right tools or to educate the people to use the right tools. Here I'm thinking about simple cryptography. There should be a right to use cryptography. It shouldn't be something bad. You shouldn't be seen as a terrorist because you're using cryptography. And there is this kind of concept which is around, and especially like in countries like Australia, is very trying to fight cryptography and trying to put backdoors in it. So here it should be the role of the state to actually make sure that the citizen have the tools to protect themselves and protect their autonomy. And also, and that's more general, the state should be be an example in the new forms of any kind of new forms of threats that are happening between private people. So there is a big development of the digital slavery right now. So your data are being used to generate value, and you are working. Your data is working, and also the governments are trying to harvest this value through big data. And again, they should be able to develop the service. We should be able to have a society that develop where the state has services which respect and don't abuse and don't go into digital slavery. So basically, at the end, the right to digital integrity next to the physical and mental integrity is just a general hat for the justification of any kind of data protection right which comes from this. But it changes the perspective of like actually protecting an individual and not just protecting data itself. So how do we implement this? So first I identified the two most important for me implementations. The first one is in the Charter of the Fundamental Rights of the European Union, Article 3. It's very simple. Everyone has a right to respect for his physical for his or her physical and mental integrity. And then there's much more achievable goal for me is the Swiss Constitution itself, where in Article 2, in the right of life, right to life, there is every person has a right to personal liberty, in particular to physical and mental integrity and, and to freedom of movement. So how do we change that? We just add one word. We add digital integrity next to both of them. So what is interesting is that we were lucky, or we are in a country which is great in some sense, because we are in a constant constitutional work, and we are voting every time to change the constitution, but also we have changes from, we have a federal state system where cantons are changing their, are renewing their constitution from time to time. So this year, it's the Valais constitution which is being completely renewed, and the context is a bit interesting because it's the third, so there was the Geneva constitution 2 years ago, and there was another Fribourg or another, it was mostly French speaking side constitutions that were done in the year of the internet. And here, they took the chance to put some of the new rights which were appearing. And the Committee on Fundamental Rights, so the one who's writing this paragraph on fundamental rights, has took this proposal, and they didn't put it exactly like with the three notions together. They made two in the same article. They make two alineas. So the first one is every human person has the right to physical and mental integrity. And they propose a second line with every human person has the right to his digital integrity. So this is going to be proposed in the plenum of the Valais Constitution in April of this year. And hopefully it was approved unanimously by the committee, and hopefully will be approved by the plenum. And what they was interesting for them is that they really took it as a generous justification. You know, they had this discussion, but what do we put inside? They put some elements in there, and but basically they liked the idea that it was giving a protective vision that was interesting. So there's been a bunch of presentation that we did, two achievements which were interesting, because we've been working silently in this. In the SWICO 2019 Digitalisierungsmonitor, that was an interview. These were questions that the national candidates had to answer. And actually, I had the chance to add questions in there. So I did just add this question, if you look it up, question 13, that was, do you think there is a right to physical digital integrity that should be added in the constitution? And the result, I only saw them a few months later because I had forgotten about it. Basically, the Green says 99% yes, and the worst were the SVP, 55% yes. Also, the Socialist Party had created a very good paper in 2015 that actually no one is, people actually forgot about it. Maybe some of you here participated a little bit in this, but this is a very interesting paper, and I had the chance also to propose them, and they added, so since 2015 actually, they have the right to digital integrity linked to the informationelle Selbstbestimmung, which they say it goes together, and it does. They explain the relationship between the two, and they have it there. They don't use it because they don't use the whole paper. But anyway, it's there. Future work, so we're moving forward with the Green and the Pirates MEPs in Brussels. And I forgot one point, very important here. Yesterday in Neuchâtel, so I'm in Neuchâtel right now, but the University of Law in Neuchâtel made the first legal event on the topic. So I was presenting the general topic. The person from the Valais conference came also to present very deep, so the presentation are available online. And then all the teacher, constitutional law teacher, criminal law, civil law, they all made arguments for, against it, and it was really interesting. So it started to create a doctrine doctrine around this. What we want to do also is publish an essay, do some legal research, and hopefully at one point launch either continental and federal initiative on this. So yeah, at the end, what can we do to support? If you want to support at one point, if you think it's a good idea, building tools that protect privacy and use it. Ask the judge in the lawsuits, and I will try to see also if some of the lawsuits in Switzerland and Germany, we can ask, okay, this particular scenario where there was an abuse of data, if we just ask the question and we create jurisprudence on it, does it harm my digital integrity? Basically, these are things we can do. We have one small website, there's a bug on it, but you can still reach it. It's mostly in French, and there's a little bit of data here to follow up. Thank you very much. I think we have a couple of seconds for questions over the pause.
Exactly, yeah. We have 10 minutes for questions. 5 minutes for questions, yeah. And I will come to you with the
microphone. 5 minutes.
Thank you for your talk, first of all. I think it's very a very interesting concept and also needed very much. But you mentioned one of the biggest challenges, which is that you don't know where your data actually is, right? Mm. You talked about defending your data, yeah. And also about digital slavery. Because you said you want the states to enable the people to defend their data. Mm-hmm. Fight digital slavery. How, you know, what are some concrete measures you would propose to do that, or how can we solve that problem that we don't know where the data actually is?
So, first important thing. These are very general principle. Okay, it's not going to solve anything in the next day. It's just a broad thing, and that might. With all the work we do in all the different things, in 30 or 20 years we got something which is more logical based on this. Huh? It's a very long work which is being done. So one example, for example, would be for the state. In every place, is very locally or whatever, depending on the service that the state is providing, they should only have the data that is necessary to provide that service. They don't need something else. So, for example, you could imagine services where, if the only data that is need to be known is the address and not the name, then they should not collect the name. So, to have this way of thinking of saying, the less we collect data to provide a specific server, the better it is. You know, this is already because it lowers down the pressure and it lowers down your responsibility of keeping all this data safe. Then, of course, we can use cryptography with this. You know, because there's a lot of things, and it's today a bit underrated, not used much. Is all the proof system in cryptography using zero knowledge proof that will come. It will be very essential of being able to certify things without sharing personal data. So these are the kind of technology that the state should be promoting, trying to be an example by not collecting data. So my wish is that I can have a public service where they don't know my name, but it's okay. They have the guarantee of who I am and what I need, and if I paid, but they don't know my name.
You mentioned your interest in history, and you also said there was a lot of blood which was spoiled for human rights to mm-hmm. put forward. So you didn't talk about the dark side, the enemies of your proposal. Who is standing up against it? What do you expect? Because I guess in the principle, all the people will say yes, but who will fight it?
Yeah, so it's interesting because the last week I was in Munich, there was this security conference, and there was one side event, which is the Pirate Security Conference, and there we have Mikuláš, which is one of our MEPs from Czech Republic. And he was starting to present his view of the world, through his side, through his point of view, which he claimed there's a new iron curtain which is being built between countries which are protective of digital human of human digital rights and state surveillance world. And hopefully we don't have this iron curtain in our own countries. Huh? But he sees that happening. So definitely there will be some like very geopolitical games. And definitely the Silicon Valley will be more inclined to treat data as a property that you can buy and sell. So that would be one of the opponents. And then we also saw some people who claim that data, personal data, should be common good and not owned by the people, but just owned by the society. So the society can do whatever they want with the data, but not the individuals. So there's a few things. In Switzerland, if we go deeper here, I think that our culture is inclined towards this, so most people would agree with this. Even at the government level, at the end, people would agree, and it would be hard to sometimes assume some of the consequences, like the right to use cryptography and the right to develop anonymity tools. That's a bit hard for people to claim. I would see that the fight would come from companies who are data-driven companies. So the most well-known example that I try to fight a bit, but the law is not on my side, is on their side right now, is companies like Moneyhouse. They're just hoarding data and making value out of it. Okay, so that would be one kind of the economy which would be the fighting this. And then the rest is the fights I see are generational. It's a generational gap. That people who are still like the senior people today were not born digitally, so they cannot understand the digital life the same way as we do today. I was lucky. I was pushed into when I was 4 years old, and I was really into a space where I could understand that from the beginning. But even me, I don't have the same understanding as my child today, who is 10 years old, and he has friend he never know. He's on his Discord channel, and he has on his Discord channel his friends from school, plus some friends from somewhere else he never met. So he has an environment which is completely mixed. For him, it will be no problem. It will be normal. So time will make us win anyway.
Okay, so unfortunately, time is over for Q&A. You have to ask Alexis himself personally, and he will be happy to answer your questions, I guess. Please give a warm applause to Alexis Russo.